Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. In this edition, I won't cover any LQ news or much Linux news, but I will cover the recent Linux World Canada Expo. First, a couple quick Linux news stories. The first one is a short article from ZDNet AU that covers the importance of open document formats. Without open document formats, your data is locked in and you are beholden to a third party to get at it. It should be obvious why this is a bad thing. In my opinion, governments and the public sector should all be looking really closely at moving toward all data that they have being in a format that they can ensure will always be accessible. Open document, an open document format for Office applications that OpenOffice.org donated to OASIS is supported in the upcoming OpenOffice.org 2 release. Next story, it looks like SCO will return to its SCOX ticker tomorrow, which is Thursday, after they received written confirmation today from the NASDAQ listing qualifications panel that it has now met all requirements. While this was a bit of good news for SCO, in the recent earnings release, revenue fell 22% to $8.9 million. Shares of stock were down slightly in after hours trading on the news. Now, on to Linux World. The show definitely had a different feel than the other Linux Worlds I've been to, mostly I think as a result of the expo floor being shared between Linux World and Network World. The conference is more suit than even the East Coast US show, and vendors such as Cisco are present, which is not something you'd normally see at a Linux World. San Francisco remains the most laid-back and developer-oriented Linux World that I've been to. The Canadian Expo is similar in size to Linux World UK, which is to say a bit smaller than the US counterparts. Most of the vendors that I talked to said that while the show was smaller and therefore had less attendees, the people who did attend were highly qualified. And what this means, qualified means coming from a vendor, is that there were a large number of decision makers present. Government attendees seem to be particularly numerous. As always, I had some great discussions, and it's always good to be able to sit down face-to-face and talk with people. I'd like to thank Stephanie Cole, who we worked with in the sponsorship and was able to get me a press pass for the show. The first session I attended was John Mad Dog Hall, and it was part of the Visionary series. One point Mad Dog made was that until the early 1980s, the only way you ever got software was with the source, even though it wasn't necessarily called open source at the time. Back then, software was actually owned by the purchasing entity, usually via contract, instead of licensed like it is today. These days, companies such as Microsoft basically are saying that they're leasing you the software, that you own nothing except they're, you know, allowing you through the license to use it. He went on to cover why software patents are evil and how they really stifle innovation. He made the point that, in most cases, patents come after software has already been written and are the work of lawyers, not programmers. He explained that, since large companies are able to build up large stockpiles of patents, they are able to negotiate with each other and avoid problems, while the little nimble companies with good ideas but know are few patents end up being the losers in the current system. He went as far to say that, given the choice between the devil, George W. Bush, and patents, that he'd pick the devil. He also wondered why software, which is an art form in his opinion, has patents, but neither music or painting does. He asked, what if Beethoven had to redo the Ninth Symphony due to patent infringement? Or, what if Michelangelo had to repaint the Sistine Chapel because someone claimed that they had patented a brushstroke that he used? Finally, he covered some proprietary software myths and some advantages of open source software. One example he used was that Microsoft once touted to him that one of their products supported almost 50 languages. After congratulating them, he explained that with open source, since anyone who finds their native language missing from a product can contribute to the project, it led to the first ever word processor support of Swahili, or all 18 official languages of India, plus many of the local tribal dialects. In the end, the possible number of languages that can be supported is nearly infinite, since a business justification case does not need to be made for each one. Overall, it was a very good session. Thanks, Mad Dog. The first keynote that I went to was from HP Canada CEO Paul Sapieris. A large part of the keynote was a Power of Linux video, which was basically a testimonial from DreamWorks. The video had some interesting bits, but was a little more pro-vendor than I'd like to see for a keynote. The video explained that over 50% of Shrek 2 was rendered remotely via HP's on-demand. The entire movie was rendered on Linux. This on-demand system allowed them to hit rendering peaks and make the deadline for the movie while only actually having to purchase enough infrastructure to do the average amount of computing required. This is the direction that a lot of computationally intensive apps seem to be going, and I know that IBM has a similar service that they're offering. While this is obviously only something that a couple of niche industries would use, it is very slick. The best quote from the movie was from a DreamWorks employee. I think it was a CTO, but I don't have it written down. He said point blank, "We are interested in Linux." He then went on to say that DreamWorks went with HP because they understood Linux. Hopefully other companies will listen to statements like this one. While it wasn't disclosed in the video, I'd say the dollar amount for the products and services purchased by DreamWorks for Shrek 2 was substantial. The presentation also explained that HP deploys Linux internally. They don't do so to eat their own dog food, as some companies claim, but they do it for the same reasons that they recommend it to their clients. They currently have over 13,000 internal devices with Linux installed. Their Linux email cluster, which is comprised of about 15 machines, processes over 3 terabits of email a year. Their entire DNS infrastructure, which is roughly 160 servers, runs Linux. They use Jabber for internal secure instant messaging, and much of their Wi-Fi network is Linux-based. Another session I attended was Revolutionizing the Software IP Value Chain by Kevin Bedell. Kevin is from Black Duck, who does software compliance management. Basically, they audit source code and tell companies if any open source is included, and if so, what requirements they need to fulfill to legally use the software. It was an interesting look at how complicated things can get when you have a software shop that integrates many bits from many different places, some of unknown origin. You'd be surprised to learn what can pop up where. Kevin noted that he had noticed that many companies are now shipping code that is mostly a variety of open source bits, with the only proprietary code basically being the glue that holds those open source bits together. The gist of the session was that using open source is a great way to accelerate code development, but you need to make sure that you have the right to sell what you are shipping. As a person who sees a lot of licenses, Kevin also said that one of the most interesting ones he has seen was the Beerware license, which basically said that if you find the software useful, you're free to use it and do whatever you want with it, but if you ever see the author, you need to buy him a beer. That wraps up the Linux World coverage and is all I have for now. Thanks for listening. And remember, if you like the LQ podcast, please head over to podcastalley.com and vote for us. Thanks.